You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to the Leadership Special, a show which features conversations with Christians in leadership about the topics that really matter. I'm Andy Peck, your host, and I've had the privilege of interviewing Christian leaders on over 1,000 shows, and so hope you'll enjoy this next conversation and will join us again next week. If you want to lead well, you need to stay focused on your vision and communicate this compellingly to others. And my guest today is involved in helping people like you do just that. He was on my show 15 years ago when we spoke especially about his work heading up a film production company, which had included projects that took him to Morocco and Moldova and included work with Pete Gregg and 24/7 prayer in Ibiza. He works today as a creative consultant, spending his time with people who run organisations of all kinds, helping them clarify and communicate vision and overcome obstacles that lie in the way. His name is Jeremy Higham, and if you're a regular listener to Premier, you may recognise the surname. He's husband to Esther Higham, who hosts Inspirational Breakfast. So welcome back, Jeremy, to the Leadership Show.
Hi, Andy.
Great to have you back. How has your work changed in the last decade and a half since we spoke?
Well, it's funny. I think it's changed, but it's also stayed essentially the same. So I think when I was a documentary maker, really looking back on that, what I loved was being dropped into worlds I knew nothing about. And in fact, some of the most successful films that I made for Channel 4 were where exactly that happened. So for example, I wasn't particularly interested in Formula One, but when I got a phone call asking if I would go and embed firstly with Damon Hill when he was leading the Formula One World Championship, and then secondly, with Eddie Irvine, when he was driving with Ferrari in a team with Michael Schumacher, that was just really exciting for me because I didn't know their worlds. And they're so used to being interviewed by, sports journalists who ask them all about racing and everything. And I just came in like some naive fool from outside. But I was just, and I always am, I'm naturally intrigued by people's worlds and what actually goes on in them. And all I did when I made those documentaries was I just asked what I wanted to know. That's the bit that hasn't really changed. It's quite self-indulgent, really, but I think it's what gives me the energy for my work. So when I then transitioned from making documentaries for TV to going into companies, it was essentially the same process. I knew that we had a responsibility to come out with a brand film or something like that for a company or an organization. But I essentially went in just with childlike intrigue and also not knowing particularly about how to run a women's fashion business or produce flat pack furniture for a worldwide market. I didn't know about those things. So I'm like, hey, what's going on in here? How does this work? And I was never short of questions because I never took in a list of questions that I thought were important for the project. I just sort of wandered in like a bit like Blue Peter used to have a thing like called the round window and the square window. You know, I'd always loved going through those windows. Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm still using childlike intrigue and fascination and asking what I instinctively want to know.
I think it was the broadcaster and writer Alistair Cook who famously said, as advice to journalists, ask a question that a child would ask. It sounds like you were doing that kind of thing in terms of being new in an environment and asking what many of us who are ignorant also might want to know.
Yeah, well, I remember a case in point was when Prince Nazim Hamid, these are all quite a long time ago, but that was when I was doing TV. So he was undefeated in like 25 fights. And I was sent out to join him in Palm Springs initially. He was preparing for his next world title fight. And I had met him previously in London to agree the project. But when I arrived out there, he was on his way. He was staying in Bing Crosby's house. And he was on his way to the kind of pool room where his ring had been temporarily set up by the training team. And he just started in the ring and he was throwing punches and sparring and everything. And I just left my camera in the back. Again, I was just looking, thinking, what do I want to know here? And I just thought, do you know what? Everybody's seen him do this. What do I want to know? So when he'd stopped, he's a little bit thrown, and he came over and he said, Jeremy, Jez, I noticed you weren't filming, mate. And I said, what I really want to know is, Naz, when you get into the real ring on the real day, are you scared? And he just stopped. It was like, no one's ever asked me that or in that way. And I remember him saying, Jez, the difference is when I get in that ring, I'm on my own. And he started to talk about the solitude. And I'm listening to this thinking, whenever I ask a question that does something in quite an unlocking way, I always get like a shiver down the back of my head. And I just had a feeling that I was learning something deeper about this young man. That's the common thing that hasn't really changed, is asking questions that you would say are like a child, i.e. I'm not trying to show off. I'm not trying to ask intelligent sounding questions. In fact, quite the opposite. One thing I learned early on is the more professionally I behaved, the less relaxed the contributor would be. Before I was a Christian, I often used to light a cigarette, and I would say, do you know, before we start the interview, do you mind if I have a quick cigarette? And they would think, I thought I was meeting some kind of scary TV professional, but this guy's just a regular bloke. So I've always tried to just take myself into these situations.
So now you're working with leaders who perhaps are struggling, or maybe they've lost their sense of vision. Are there particular common struggles you tend to find as you have these kind of conversations with people?
That is almost like asking, if when parents are raising teenagers, are there a set of common struggles? It's like the common struggle is running a business.
Right.
It's people who don't run a business and look at websites, think, wow, what a well-organized company Selfridges is, clearly free of problems. Wow, you know, Octopus Energy, they've got it all together. Look, they're taking over the world. It's never like that. In the same way that a family showing up to a wedding all in their tie and best dresses, yeah, we know what's gone on to get there. The arguments over the shower and the stresses and all of those things. So because I'm from a family who ran a company for 100 years in Lancashire, and then I've run businesses myself, I've never been employed actually, I know that any business I go into, any organization, especially, we'll probably talk about this later, church leaders. I've got lots of mates who are church leaders. Luckily, I was turned down for ordination. When I chat to them over a pint, I'm just like flipping egg, mate. And I used to think running a church as an organization was quite a romantic thing to aspire to. You know, you turn up at a big flourishing church and you think, wow, lucky leader, he gets listened to every Sunday. You only realize when you try one of these things how flipping difficult they are. And I'd say running a business is fairly near top of that list.
And do people typically come to you when things are really bad? I mean, it takes a lot for people to come to a consultant.
I think somebody said the sense they got was a bit that I'm a bit like a corporate chiropractor. I've started using that phrase quite a bit. And people go, oh, I kind of get that. So nobody goes to a chiropractor until the ache gets to an unbearable or slightly intolerable level. They'll generally cope, you know, they'll stretch a bit more, they'll take some pills, and eventually it's like, do you know what? I'm going to go and see the chiropractor. So I feel that that is a good analogy for what I do, is that people come when a particular problem is presenting. And it won't go away. It's become critical. It's spoiling the journey. Top of the list is usually profitability, or if it's a charity, fundraising, what have you. Or I had one quite big fashion, privately led fashion company came where the founder was just getting depicted in the press as some Eton toff and not as somebody who actually really understood fashion and worked hard to build the business. So that was a different kind of thing. But generally, it's an ache. It's hurting. But what is also interesting, and I'm learning, is any good chiropractor rarely addresses the presenting ache. When I go to the chiropractor in Edenbridge, he never goes, if I say, do you know what? When I'm in bed, I'm such a stiff neck in the morning. He never goes, oh, right, let's treat the neck. He goes, walk up and down the room a few times, Jeremy, let me have a look. And he's always looking wider, scanning wider than the presenting problem, knowing that the stiff neck is the symptom, but it's not the cause. The cause is normally embedded deeper in the body. And that is a good analogy for what I do. Shortage of money, low profitability, tends to suggest there's something in the mechanism or the way the mechanism of the businesses interact with the outside world that is not aligned. There's something out of kilter, and there's usually a good reason why it's out of kilter. And we need to find out what that reason is and see if we can unlock. It's normally what I do is unlock something that's already there. It's just bound up.
I was going to ask Jeremy whether you have some classic questions that you ask. From our conversation thus far, my suspicion is maybe not that you
I
allow a
have a
person.
classic question.
You
I
do?
have
Oh,
a
you do.
classic question. Ah, if we get a quiet meeting room or a coffee space, we sit down. I just look at the person and I say, right, what's going on? What do you see? What do you see through your windscreen? And I start as open as I can. A bit like if you meet somebody for a tennis game that you've not played with them before, you just knock a gentle shot over the net, don't you? And it's when they begin to respond that you're like, oh, okay, I can see what kind of tennis player we're dealing with. And then I gradually move in and start hitting the ball a little bit harder.
Have you found occasions where it's been quite clear you're not able to help?
Yes, it was a small business in our town, actually. The people running it, well, actually, it was just outside our town. The people running it were really struggling financially with the business. They just weren't making any money. And after a few sessions, what I realized was I was speaking to somebody who needed help and was open to a conversation, but was not ready to change. People who have struggled for a long time get so used to dealing with everything and rarely asking for help or being ready to receive any kind of outside helpful influence that it's almost like, yeah, but they keep saying. So I say, have you thought about possibly trying this? Oh, yeah, we've thought of that. Oh, no, we tried that. We tried that. You know, I can be quite blunt, a bit like a chiropractor. You know, if they need to shift something that's tight, they might warn you a little bit that I'm going to now manipulate your shoulder. This may hurt a little bit. And then they pull no punches. They go, and they're doing it because they believe that's what it's going to take to unlock something. I am trying to be loving. And part of that loving is to confront something quite boldly. So I have been in meetings where I have, and this is one of the techniques that I use. I ask a question and they say, oh, yeah, no, we've already thought of that. And then I ask another one. They say, oh, even before I finish the question. So what I tend to say is, can I just start? No, next time I ask a question, I want you to shut up, don't speak, and write the question, thank me, and write the question down. So I then repeat that. I say, okay, are you ready for that? The next time I ask you a question, have you properly looked into the companies that are exactly like you within 25 miles of here? The next time I ask a question like that, don't speak, don't reply. Say thank you for the question and write it down. And the reason I say that is I want to get them into the habit of every time somebody who looks at their business asks them a question, they realize that person has seen something they cannot see because they don't have external perspective. That is a very valuable insight they've just been given. It's hidden in a polite question, but it's a valuable insight. It's almost a recommendation. So the wisest thing to do is to value that almost in monetary terms, it's valuable. Thank the person for the gift of that question. write it on a bit of paper, and then go away and think about that question and respond in a few days, not seconds. It's actually very rare to hear founders pause and listen to a question and consider it carefully. The knee jerk is to say, oh, no, we've already thought of that.
Well, it sounds like ego is a big issue within that sort of setup.
It's not ego in a bad way. I always think pride and ego are simply our defense mechanism. I have all of that going on in myself because we think in the same way that we think a great deal about our children and put a huge amount of care into how we brought them up, so we think a great deal about our business and our organization. And so we need to defend ourselves from unloving criticism. And so we have all these things ready. These are our defense mechanisms, like, don't go near that. We've already thought of it.
Yeah,
Do
sure.
you mind me asking, what is behind that locked door? Oh, no, we never go behind the locked door. It's fine, it's locked. I actually have had that in a big financial services company. I said, right, I think we should go into that space out there onto that mezzanine and do some practice. Oh, no, we never unlock the mezzanine. And I just said, why? And they went, because. I said, hold on a sec. Put the becauses down. What would it take to get that door unlocked in the next half an hour? Within half an hour, that door was unlocked. We all went out there and something quite extraordinary happened. So
Yeah.
that's the other thing I'm doing is confronting. This is the way we've always done it. It has to be thus.
Jeremy, in the commercial and charity worlds, leaders need to fix problems to survive. Do you think it's easier for churches to struggle but not be aware of it because perhaps of a different dynamic that takes place in a community of a church where perhaps they don't have goals in the same sort of way?
My gosh, when I went for ordination, the leader of our church in London, a guy called John Peters, said to me, Jeremy, I think you have a very romantic view of church leadership. And he was dead right. I had only a few years come to Jesus through Alpha. It was a very powerful, supernatural experience. I was just always on a bit of a spiritual high. And I just thought, wow, if I run a church, I could do this every day. And I could speak about what I cared about every Sunday. And I could pray for people. Wouldn't that be amazing? Oh my gosh. I would now say running a church, whatever that means, is one of the hardest forms of leadership probably on earth. So anybody who is doing it even half well, whatever that means, my gosh, I have admiration for you. You are assailed on so many sides, only one of which is your own personal life going on at home. And all the challenges of that, your personal health, your personal relationship with God, that's only one part of the hidden side. You're also dealing with bishops or supervisors. You're also dealing with congregation, one end of which are on fire for Jesus or don't even know who he is. And the other end have been in church so long, they are utterly calcified and set in their ways, some of them. And they basically want to just bellyache about you behind your back after every Sunday service, and you are God to some of them, whether you like it or not. They've chosen you as their incarnate God, and they're going to lay all their problems at your feet. Incredibly difficult. But I actually do love meeting with church leaders. It's quite funny because I feel like I have always been a small p priest and minister. When I saw the priesthood of all believers, I was like, ah, I know that's me. Because even when the Church of England said, kind of, Jeremy, we get where you're coming from, but you're just not going to fit in our structure. They said it very politely, but I understood what they meant. I just had this feeling inside. I feel like I've already been ordained by Jesus. When I received the Holy Spirit, I could just feel it. And I basically don't have a kind of off switch. I'm kind of feel like I'm on duty as a small p priest, and I blow with the wind of the Spirit probably a bit more than somebody who runs a formal church. When I meet with my mates who were ordained in an earthly way by somebody and have formal office, I love chatting with them. And what becomes immediately apparent is, wow, how restricted you are, both by the framework you're in and the expectations of it. But also, how restricted I think you've become by what you think you have to do in order to be a leader, stimulant, football manager in the body of Christ. So I ask the same questions I ask founders of businesses. After I've kind of, how are things? And they've kind of gone, well, this and well, that. I say, okay. I always say, what's the worst of it? What are you hating? And normally they take a deep breath as if to say, I'm actually allowed to just be honest about that right now. And they'll probably say something like, I'm hating the relentless rhythm of having to flipping drum up a talk every Sunday. And I'm hating the fact that we haven't got a worship team. And I say, and what are you loving? And they go, blimey, slightly lost track of that. I said, well, what do you actually love doing? And they say, well, I say, look, I noticed on your laptop there's mountains. Do you love going up mountains? Yes. And I notice on your home computer there's like a massive yacht. Do you like sailing? Yes. So I'm like, do you ever integrate these two lives? I mean, do you ever like have church up mountains, or do you ever take groups out on your boat and do church there? And for some, that is like, are we actually allowed? Am I as a leader actually allowed to do things I actually enjoy? Don't I just have to do the things that you see on all the evangelical church websites, which is have a kind of building with rows of chairs and a pulpit slightly higher than them? And don't I just have to do those things and then have home groups and then turn up at New Wine? I'm like, you don't have to do any of that, mate. As long as you're not subverting the metrics that your overseers have put on you, which is probably to build the body of Christ and make disciples who are equipped to actually go out and do what Jesus could do. As long as you're roughly doing that, how can they argue? And obviously, don't break the law or be casual with safeguarding. But I would, a bit like I said to the financial services company, get a few of these doors unlocked and get out there and have a play, start enjoying what you're doing. Because if you do that, you will liberate others within your congregation to realize, hang on, I love putting on, we love having people around to our house. We love five-a-side football. It's like, get on and do it. Just do it with the spirit alive inside you. And, but a lot of businesses run in the same way. You know, they get so set in what this is how it should be. They find it hard to think outside that. And therefore, quite helpful, I think, when somebody like me comes in who's like, I don't have to run this church for you, but I could, we could loosen some covers that are on stuff. Somebody said to me, Jeremy, you're a discoverer. You're a great discoverer. You diss the cover. It's like a drain cover that's got rusted up. And I'm like, hang on, what's under there? What's under there? Has it all got blocked, or is it running freely? And they're like, oh, you can't take that cover off. It's always been there. I'm like, yes, I can. Step back. And I give the drain cover a good kick with their permission. And I think I do quite a lot of that. I'm like, let's get that rusty tap working and get some life flowing in here. So we can mainly get your happiness back as a leader, your creativity, your daring, your risk-taking. Because without that, this business ain't going to move forward, whether it's a church or a commercial company.
That's fascinating stuff, Jeremy. And I think people could valuably listen back to that last 10 minutes, especially if they're in church leadership, and just reflect on what excites them again, and be reinvigorated. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work with people, helping them in their communication. We've not got long to go, but I just wonder if there are a few pointers that you use to help people who feel like they're stuck, they're not communicating particularly well, maybe, or that they've lacked a sense of passion and heart in their communication.
What particularly communication are you thinking about?
Verbal.
Yeah, it all comes under the same. It's all the same. I feel like I'm just doing the same thing. I'm never going to a business or a church to put Jeremy-ness in. I'm never going, you need me and my creativity. No, you don't. You just need help to unlock what's within you that's not been released or it's got stuck. Like the chiropractor can't come jump into your body and bring you there. Physical freedom. They're just, let's get you fully going. And so quite often I'll meet people and they'll say, for example, they want to have a go at vlogging, but they say, oh, I'm frightened of cameras. I look awful. I'm like, great, let's challenge that in a minute. Because I think you look normal. I think you look like you. So let's challenge that. Also, I never know what to say, or okay, or it takes me ages to prepare a sermon. So I just listen carefully. Because normally when they describe what can't happen, that is how they have bound themselves. They've tied themselves up with that reality. And the next thing I do is say, okay, let's not put you in front of an audience at New Wine with no script and free roll. Let's not do that straight away. That would be unkind. But let's just have a bit of time together where we can play an experiment without pressure. I say to people, I solve serious problems in playful ways. So quite often, somebody struggles to speak without notes, for example, or they hate speaking because they hate the adrenal feeling they get when they walk up in front of people. The first thing I tell them is that most people who are afraid of public speaking that I've worked with over the years, and I've worked with a lot, normally have quite a powerful gift inside them to communicate. Somehow that gift has got stuck underneath some fear, collapsed masonry of fear has fallen on that. And the reason they have a wellhead of passion, which comes out as adrenaline, is there's something in there that's trying to get out. And it creates quite a vibration of energy, which feels like trembling fear. But actually, it's something in there that's trying to get out. So what I do is I say, great, why don't you stand up? Let's go outside in the car park for a minute. I'm not going to give you any warning. I'm going to take out my iPhone, stick it on this little selfie stick. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to point it at you deliberately to scare you a bit. Are you ready? I'm going to deliberately frighten you now. Okay, stare at this camera. Oh, I don't want to. I say, right, now listen to me. In a moment, with no warning, I'm going to ask you to talk about something. I'm going to walk backwards slowly, and I want you to help me understand. It doesn't matter whether you stumble, burble, even fall over. It doesn't matter. But I want you to help me understand something that I don't know. Now, what they don't realize is that I have observed during our conversation something they love. For example, they might have told me they've just been mountaineering and they love being up there in the cold. And I'll press play and I say, are you ready? They go, yeah. I say, are you sure you're ready? Yeah, I'm ready. I say, help me understand what it is you love about being up a mountain in the cold. So what I do is I go straight to something I know is in their heart. I say, right, help me understand. I don't say, present like a BBC presenter. I say, help me understand. And what I've noticed again and again is suddenly I have now connected their heart with their mouth, not an agenda they think they need to bring, not a script they've prepared for a week, just their heart. I've given them no time to think about it or worry or stress or practice. And what comes out is almost always so beautifully eloquent, passionate, and well-ordered and convincing. I quite often put the phone down and I just do that and I mean it. And then I'm able to say, you are an excellent communicator. So essentially, I prophetically now reclaim who they really are. I never flatter. That is very dangerous in my game. I just tell them honestly what I've observed. And they say, oh, but my hands were all over the place. And I say, yes, so were David Bellamy's. So were Chris Evans's, so were some of the most famous presenters in television in the last 50 years. They use their hands because they are natural orators. So don't let anybody ever tell you to put them by your side again. All I'm doing is liberating what is in there, not trying to force some media training on them. I would say, I mean, you could ask some of our clients, I've got a pretty good track record of unlocking frightened people. Now, once people realize they can communicate, they can then begin to enjoy it and realize, actually, I'm quite flipping good at this. Once they enjoy it and they realize they're quite good at it, then we can get a stream of content coming from them, from their heart via their mouth to the audience, and put to one side the agenda. What ought I be saying to be cool, to be convincing, to make the bishop delighted? We get rid of all that oughtishness. And we reconnect the heart. How
Fascinating.
much fun is that? That's what I do for a living.
Wonderful. Well, it's fascinating to chat with you again, Jeremy, after 15 years or so. Well, time's defeated us, but how can listeners get in touch with you if they wanted to follow up on something?
Well, they can just write to me. It's my name, Jeremy, with a J, and then an at, squiggly at. And then when my name is Hyam, which I always explain is the first bit is high, the opposite of low. And the second bit is AM, the opposite of PM, i.e. morning and evening, Hyam. And then it's dot co. It's dot co. It's not dot co dot UK or dot com. It's the worst branding mistake we ever made, which is to give ourselves a strange URL, but that's it. Jeremy at Hyam.co.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for all you've shared, and exciting to have a little bit of an insight into your working day.
Thank you.
It was super to chat with Jeremy Hyam. That email address again is jeremy@hyam.co, or you can go to jeremyhyam.com, his website, and the contact page there will enable you to get in touch. Maybe it's time for you to reflect a little bit on what took you into the leadership you're doing. Maybe you have lost the joy that Jeremy reflected on, and maybe it's time to do some reflection and get back in touch with your heart, as he suggested. As always, there's plenty of archive leadership show material. Go to premier.plus, to the app or the website, or to the podcast provider where you get your podcasts, and you can find many, many hundreds of past shows. So this is your host, Andy Peck. Thank you for your company. Looking forward very much to the next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.